I guess I should start. So again, my name is Jennifer Silverman. I am most recently the editor of a book called My Baby Rides the Short Bus, The Unabashedly Human Experience of Raising Kids with Disabilities. I've also worked with a collective of mothers called MAMA, Mothers Alliance for Mutual Aid, and we worked actively from about 2002 to 2006. And we're sort of in the stages of reforming as more of an online presence. I also worked as a community organizer in East New York for 5 years, and a lot of that was working with mothers and families. And right now I'm a graduate student at Queens College in Urban Studies, and I'm hoping to use that work to make cities more family friendly. So.
My name's Elliot, sorry I just got here a little late. I'm with the Regeneración Child Care Collective and other various projects that are going on. I don't know, I'll have more to share after I sit and absorb for a minute.
And I'm Lauren Karchmar, and I'm part of Regeneración, and should you introduce yourself and we can talk a little bit about our organization?
Sure, do you want us to do that? And then
okay. I'm Eliana Mendez-Piñate, and I'm also part of the Regeneración Child Care Collective.
So just a little brief on what our Child Care Collective is about. Is we're a group of, I guess there's like what, 10 of us in the collective, and we do a lot of support work for families that are involved in movement building work throughout the city. So there's a couple of organizations that are like our partner organizations that we work really closely with, and that we... we do our best to provide childcare for their meetings and events basically any time that they need it, so that the caregivers can be in those meetings or participating in those events fully, or as fully as they want to be. And then we also do like programming, like children's programming at different things, and we do curriculum work with the kids as well. It's kind of a newer part that we're working on. So that it's our time is a little, I don't know, that we're building something with the kids, that we're having a little curriculum to build our relationships with them around.
No, I think the only thing I would add to that is that I think we see our work, I think a central part of our work is providing childcare meetings and facilitating the participation specifically of like women of color and queer parents, of folks that are really directly impacted by oppression. And I think that we coined this term called intergenerational movement building. So I think when we envision our work, I think part of it is facilitating childcare. Another part of it is helping organizations incorporate children into their programming and events. And the third part of it is a little bit more amorphous, but it's about kind of encouraging relationship building between childcare providers and the families within our organizations that kind of extend beyond just meeting each other at meetings or events, but kind of speak to encouraging people to practice mutual aid and see kind of child care as everybody's work.
That's good.
Okay. I'm Anthony Ryder. and I just moved to New York City like 2 months ago, and I've been working at Metropolitan Community Church. Has a food pantry and a homeless shelter.
My name is Alicia Canary. I'm an artist in the Common Threads Art Collective, which is part of the Retail Action Project. And I'm a master's student in the Labor Studies program at the CUNY Murphy Institute, and I'm the mom, so it's really interesting.
My name is RJ McCotty, and I'm also a member of Van Axel.
I'm Amanda Venger, and I am one of the founders of Indie Kids. It was the newspaper over there for kids in grades 4 to 8, and it's kind of like Time for Kids or Junior Scholastic, but grassroots and progressive. And I'm a full-time parent of a 2.5-year-old right now, and I'm a student at Hunter to be an education teacher, a teacher of K-12.
I'm Scott Matthews. I'm a parent of a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old, and I'm not really here affiliated with anyone, but I'm a teacher too.
In the state, I'm dead.
Yeah, this year I'm in the
state. And his wife. And I'm teaching full time this year. Last year I was home.
And I teach fifth grade at 321 in Brooklyn. And I'm a parent to a 5-year-old and an almost 2-year-old.
What's your name?
I'm Rhonda Matthews.
Okay. Thanks for coming. And so we had set this up thinking, you know, in a larger group that we would do these panel discussions each on this topic and then do the breakout groups. But I'm thinking since we have, you know, a smaller, nice group that it would be great if there's something that you want to jump in on what we're talking about, you know, just feel free to interrupt us. Our, you know, intention was to talk based on our experiences that we've had in our different groups and our different communities. And so, again, the first question that we were going to start with is a two-parter, and it is, why is it important generally to have families or kids involved and accommodated in activist communities? And then how does it benefit the groups to have spaces where kids and parents feel welcomed and supported? So, you know, first, how does it benefit the families? But then also, how does it have a positive impact on the groups? So...
Do you want to start?
Sure.
Sorry, our rhythm's a little thrown off with the three compared to the four. So,
So Indie Kids is really not a kids project. Often people think it's kids who are producing the newspaper, but we do have some kids involved. It's mostly produced by adults. And we... but since we're writing about... we're writing about complex issues like the economy and things like that. It's not always easy to find ways in which young kids can contribute. But I guess I would just say that we have open meetings, so anyone can come, including kids. And a lot of times, kids are very useful in our process because if they're reading. We try to find activities in which they can really feel that they're contributing. We proofread our papers and before it goes to print, and that's where kids have a lot to say about what should be changed, which is good because there's still time to make changes. And then also our bundling party, which is where we just count papers and stuff them in envelopes before we mail them, and that's also a lot of fun and anyone can contribute. So. So out of our whole production cycle, we try to find ways in which kids can be involved, and anyone is welcome to our meetings, and as much as possible, we try to make it interesting for kids.
Sorry, I'm thinking about a lot of things as the just thinking about the question, but actually I have a question. Do the kids come? So kids come to your meetings?
Not so many, because our meetings are in the evenings, and I think that if we were really to involve kids, we have to be more community based. And we usually meet in Manhattan at it's from 7 to 9 in the evening. So maybe we need to actually look at having more weekend meetings, and that might be able to draw more kids that way. But it's really parents who are already activists who want to bring their kids, and so it's kind of we have more families involved with Indie Kids. We have a couple homeschool kids, and then there's a family of four, so they're involved. And then we have some activist parents who bring their kids, and sometimes it's just one time, or But we have a few families who have been contributing for a long time. One kid who started writing for Indie Kids when he was 7, he's now 9, going on 10.
Yeah, I think that, we think that that having families and kids involved is super important, that... That it's about families. That when we're talking about movement building, where Gilly said we're working towards this idea of intergenerational movement building, and we think that the multiple generations is essential to living out this vision that we have of the world. that it's not just about adults, that it's about kids being a part of that process, and to have families feeling welcomed and supported means that they participate and means that that we get that I don't know, that richness that comes from it.
So it's funny because I wrote down multi-generational movement building, which is, you know, largely the same idea. But when we were doing MAMA, that was a really big issue for us. And MAMA was a collective. There were about five or six of us in the core group, and we really wanted to bring to light issues that were affecting women, especially low-income mothers, and how we'd all come together as people who had been activists for years, and then once we were parents, we didn't have that space anymore, and people kind of expected that we were going to drop out. You know, my friend Vicky tells a story. She was one of the original core group members, but she's also been extremely involved in activism on the Lower East Side for, you know, 20 years or something. And she would go to meetings, and people were like, "Oh, it's really nice that you're here to support your partner."
Hello.
Hello.
And
welcome.
Thank you. So, going back to that idea, you know, and I hate to throw out the word sustainability all the time, but movements are really not sustainable if you have a group of young childless people, and then they become parents, and they have to drop out.
Right.
And then you have to start all over again. So how do you get that intergenerational or multi-generational movement building if you're not having people, you know, building towards that? And also, if you look at the way parents are raising the next generation. You know, no one wants their kids to grow up thinking, oh, like, mom and dad leave us at home so they can go do exciting things out in the streets and, you know, or go to meetings and be bored out of their minds, which I've seen happen with some of my friends' kids. Personally, you know, I have a parent of a child who's turning 12 in May who's significantly developmentally disabled, and his four-year-old brother, and I have different challenges with each of their ages and issues because of that, and keeping them involved in activist lives. So, you know, when spaces are child-friendly or family-friendly and accommodating, it gives us as parents the opportunity to continue doing the work that we were doing before and teaching the next generation that they are important and valued. And something that I just saw when I was in California, when I was at the Anarchist Book Fair, was this just amazing group of parents and kids of all ages. And I don't think I've ever seen a conference or an event like that, where there were just so many kids who seemed so happy to be there. So I think that was a really wonderful moment.
Hello.
Hi. Yeah, if you folks who just walked in don't mind taking a minute to introduce yourselves, we were just going through a list of panel questions.
I'm Janice Marie Johnson. I work at the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations as the Director of Racial and Ethnic Concerns.
Alice, I'm part of Greenhouse.
I'm Bev Ray. I'm with the Canadian Union of Postal Workers and longtime activist. For many, many years, worked on advocacy issues for persons with disabilities. I have an adult daughter with a developmental disability. And so there's a real sort of, the kinds of things that I was involved with when my daughter was younger, for like 12, 13, 14 years, around social justice issues for people with disabilities is similar to the kinds of issues that a lot of working people experience, whether it's with respect to family issues or work issues or global issues. So that's my.
So I'm going to move on to our next question, unless anyone wants to ask her.
What was your first question?
That's a good question. We were discussing why it's important to have families and kids involved and accommodated in activist communities, and how it benefits groups that make that step towards accommodating them. How groups benefit.
I might throw something in.
Absolutely.
Because what you were speaking about resonated in the sense that a lot of, like, younger parents that I know that are involved in some sort of social movement stuff. Just that a lot of some of the younger parents that I know that are involved in social movement stuff and have kids feel a sort of divide, that they feel their lives sort of pulled apart because their social movements have all sorts of goals, and some of them are like immediate and are organized around in ways that have like require tons of energy and time, and those are like keep this house from getting evicted or like win this concession so we have these resources, and then there are longer term goals that are like make beautiful communities that can regenerate themselves and like enhance everyone's capacity to like live wonderful lives. And I don't know, I guess my reaction to what you were saying was like if movements aren't built in such a way that families participate, then they're going to be skewed toward certain kinds of goals and certain ways of meeting them that'll be for people that have like their lives organized in certain ways and that doesn't involve children. But then
right.
Incorporating like families into the way those movements are organized changes the scope of what that movement is and its goals and how it'll go about meeting those things, you know?
Right. I mean, to that point also, I think my commitment as an activist and my priorities changed once I had children. You know, in a way that hopefully doesn't sound cheesy, I became much more invested in making a better world for the people that I was responsible for bringing into it. So, you know, issues that I maybe hadn't spent much time on before became more important.
And I think, one more thing. I think something that we're also thinking about is a type of layering, because many of the organizations that we work with, we work with mostly women of color who are immigrants. So there already kind of exist a lot of networks and ways of incorporating children into like daily practices. And so it's kind of layering that upon with kind of some different values and commitments that we share politically. And so I think that that's something that we thought about as an organization also. So like, because in a way, we're mimicking things that are already happening in different ways, but we're just kind of adding a different vision or a different set of goals.
So some of these questions are going to have a lot of overlap because it's kind of hard to separate them out. But the next question we had was, how are folks now making their organizations family inclusive, and what kind of obstacles have they faced along the way? If you don't mind starting.
How have we made things more family inclusive? I think that one of the groups that we partner with is Domestic Workers United, and they a lot of their actions now include or have included like a kids component. Like we had a children's vigil that that we planned with them, and there's always a place for the families of the people who are involved in the group to be there and to feel, you know, to add their part to it. And it's very, like, essential to the whole thing. So that's one. And then we also partner with an organization called Families for Freedom. And they, all the families there, the immediate families have been affected by immigration. So parents are in detention or have been deported, and they, you know, they really like they have a fundraiser every, we were talking about this earlier, that they have a fundraiser every year that we go and we do childcare at, but they, and like there's a space that's set aside for like where the kids can play and like where we can play with the kids, but every year we end up, it's just all one big thing, and it's fun, it's so much fun, and like there's a space where kids can go and like just be with kids, and there aren't really many adults there, and you know we're all there, but there's also the rest of the party that's happening where everyone is looking out for the kids, and like everyone is making sure they're fine, and none of us are worried about the kids, you know, being hurt or getting into trouble, and like and this year we all went and spontaneously did a dance number in the floor with all of the parents. And I think that it's just, you know, their whole way that they it makes it easier for us to do childcare in spaces like that, you know.
Yeah, and I think to add something to what you're saying is that in terms of obstacles, I think it's really hard to change the culture of organizations and have moms and caretakers specifically trust that their kids are going to be taken care of while they're in a meeting and that they're going to be well attended to. And I think that's something that we've learned through our practice is that how important it is to have consistency in terms of like who are the people that are taking care of your kids, because within that consistency then relationships mm-hmm. can develop, and a mom is or a parent is much more likely to bring their kid to a meeting if they know who we are, if they like feel comfortable with us, if they have a relationship with us that they know that we share similar values about how they're going to treat their kids. So I think then in practice that's something that we really try to work on. Mm-hmm. In terms of getting
it. Samantha, did you want to answer that? I should also bring up that we were waiting for Zero Priestess to hopefully show up. So if she walks in, we're just going to have her introduce herself and join us. So for me, I'm going to answer that mostly about Mama. The whole impetus behind this organization, you know, this collective of mothers, is that everything we were going to do was going to be family friendly. We always had children in our meetings. You know, we try to enlist our friends and allies to come help us out to keep the kids from, you know, running down the stairs. We were meeting at the time either in playgrounds, which was ideal, you know, when the weather was permitting, or at ABC in Rio, and that became a big problem because, as everyone knows, space is a huge premium in New York, and we were totally grassroots. We got one grant, I think, in the entire time we were together, a small grant to organize an event, and so we didn't have space, regular space, and when we met at ABC in Rio during the winter, the heat didn't always work. We found out there was lead paint on the windowsills, and the building itself, if you've ever been there, is, first of all, not accessible, and secondly, like, kind of a disaster. But luckily, they just raised all this money. They're redoing the whole thing to a green building. It's going to be wonderful. But so that was a huge obstacle for us. And also, you know, as mothers, we were always responsible for taking care of our kids. And we started to get really burned out on feeling like we were always organizing around the same issue. And this is before, you know, they existed as a group. So this is going back a few years. So also the Left Forum is interesting to me because I've never gone to the Left Forum before, specifically because they didn't have childcare available. And every year we asked.
So that's why there's not a whole lot of people here.
Yeah. And this year I called up and they said, we have childcare plans. And I thought, okay, that's wonderful. I'm going to do this panel, get everyone together, and, you know, we'll be able to have our kids here and have these incredible discussions. And then a few weeks ago, I called to double check on the childcare and found out that it had been pulled, which, you know, I don't know the intricacies of what happened. I just know there was a financial issue with the people they were contracting with, and it fell through. And it didn't seem like there was a backup plan. And so, you know, to me, this is an obstacle right now. My husband is at a playground with my kids and a friend so that I can be here, but, you know, how many parents are not here right now because, not just in this room, but at this conference because they don't have childcare or, you know, it's a beautiful day, you know, they want to be outside with their kids because this place wasn't set up. So thank you, Left Forum, for giving us the space to be here, but it would be better if it was more accommodating.
Or if, adding on to that, I think there's two parts. One is childcare and one is including children, and those are two different things.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because we have two kids, and we, in the beginning, were bringing our oldest one to green events with us. But then it was just because we're Green Party members, but you would think the Green Party would be more family-friendly than other political parties. And they, kids were always welcome, but it just wasn't the right place to have a kid. You know, like, so we've stopped going to most of the events because, you know, with two kids, especially if they're okay, we can't do that. And I wish, and this is something we should probably work on, and one of the reasons we're at this meeting today is that, like, there should be something that includes my kids more than just childcare events.
So that actually leads right to the next question that we were going to talk about, which is what are the values that we think are important when working with kids and having kids in our space? instead of just providing childcare, you know, how do we make things about involving them? So,
well, can I just ask and follow up? What kinds of? I'm just curious. What kind? How could the Green Card or some of the events that you've been to? How could they have been adapted to include your kids?
Well, we're part of Park Slope Greens, which really should be, you know, Park Slope. It's like wow. Strong, like it's just Kid Central. So it really should be, and I mean, I haven't taken the leadership role to make that happen. But we went to a talent show that was not child friendly at all to raise money, and then events like this, where adults are all sitting in a room talking, is not where you'd want my almost 2 year old. Mm-hmm. You know, as much as we're all kid friendly, you wouldn't want him here right now.
Right.
And so, it'd be nice, if the Greens did an event, where we all did something in a park. You know, and it was an event talking about our values and actually doing activities around it with kids. I'm not sure. I haven't brainstormed it out. But that would be nice where my kids felt included, exactly like you were saying, where my activities of what my beliefs are isn't something that pulls me away from my family, but something that includes my family.
So I have some really good models to share also, but I want to see if you guys want to answer that first.
Well, at my church, Community Church of New York, every activity that we have for adults, we have mirror programming for children. I think it started a few years ago. It started when I worked there and thought, well, I wouldn't have been able to attend one of the fabulous workshops that I planned to share if I didn't have childcare. But then, you know, over the years, thinking about, well, if we're talking about anti-oppression on the adult level, there is a way to have a conversation around something comparable with 4-year-olds and with 8-year-olds and so on. So over the years, I was able to do that. But I have to say, I made it happen. I was adamant. I also had the maybe blessing of another cultural experience, that this is what we do in Jamaica, so it's easier for me to bring that sensibility here. And also we had resources. Mm-hmm. So that's really important. And if we, you know, when we were having tight money issues, it's, well, let's give up on food so we can do this with and for the children. But it's prioritizing resources too. So it's complex.
I think it's also the resources of the families included, because if you could afford childcare, if I can speak for you, he went to a PTA meeting at our school. It was a PTA meeting, and he was the only one there with a younger child. And other people had nannies watching their kids, but the reason we can't afford a nanny is because he gave up his salary to be a stay-at-home dad. Do you see the catch 22? And next year when he's back at work, he can't go to the PTA meeting because he's at work. So even at our school, which is kid-friendly because it's a school, is not as family-friendly as, they don't provide childcare, so parents can go to the PTA meetings. So how many people weren't at the PTA meeting because they were home with their younger child? And he's the only one that was willing to go with the younger child because it's this is his year home and he wants to be part of the PTA. So we sometimes get frustrated with that catch-22. It's we can't afford a nanny because of that. And we have friends watching our kids today. So
I think that we're all here because we all share a feeling that the world as it is now doesn't function well in general. It's not really thoughtful or conscious or we have some serious barriers, and I think that what I'm interested in is we have to in different ways for each of us create a new space that's our space and that hopefully transforms the things that it touches along the way. I think as far as the values that are important when working with kids, I think that one of the major values is that care is for everyone, that caring about each other and knowing each other and building relationships with each other is that's how to make this new space, you know, this new world. And like, and one thing that we say a lot is that childcare is everyone's work. And like, and for the Left Forum to know that it's the Left Forum organizers' work, and like, and for all of us to know that it's not just about taking care of our own kids. I mean, I don't have any kids, but like, you know,
right.
For each of you to take care of your own kids. Yeah, that's one part of it. But like, then having the kids at home with a nanny is so sad because they can't. The nanny's not going to teach them the kind of things that they would be learning if they're like just interacting with other kids, even, you know. I'm not laughing about this. So childcare is everyone. Oh, the other thing I wanted to say is that like that a big value that we have is just relationship building too, and like and teaching kids relationship building and really pushing towards that and encouraging that, and we all build relationships with the kids probably there's not a lot of kids you can keep us from building relationships with, but that is important because like having a relationship is something that's lacking in like the PTA thing, and like and maybe is lacking with the Left Forum organizers too, like understanding that relationship is like a but having a relationship to the kids and relationship to the work, it's all, I don't know, I guess it's important to feel like a depth there that we don't often see.
I'm just thinking, like, with respect to this Left Forum, and if I was looking at the front of the book and, you know, in terms of who's on their board and that, I have a sneaking suspicion that if you look at this, generally the majority of the people that are on this board are people that, if they do have children, their children are grown up and they're not living at home.
I know the organizer for the Left Forum has kids.
So, but, you know, it's that question in terms of where they are in their life, and
yeah.
I think that, you know, when you're looking at things like the Left Forum or similar kinds of issues, if I look at working within the union that I work in, you know, there's a sentiment that there's a general percentage of people that are apathetic, which I'm not convinced that they are. I think it's because they have a multitude of different things that are going on in their lives, and a lot of it is based on family, right? Whether you have children or you have another partner, you work different shifts. And you know, like I have three kids, and with them growing up, wondering, like, how do I engage my kids to start being independent thinkers as they grow up? And I think even with the Left Forum, having events, you know, or like with the green group that you're involved with, events that allow people to be involved that their kids are there, that's one step. But I think the other step is that what do you do when the kids are there? So it's not just about them playing, but that there's play-based activities to encourage them to think about the kinds of things that you're involved in. Because when my kids were younger, you know, it would be like, you know, what is your mom do? Why is my mom at these meetings? You know, why is it that the issues of inclusion of kids with disabilities, well, it impacts my other two kids because they're siblings of a young person with a disability. And so there's lots of social issues that are related to that. And I think just some of the other panel discussions I've been in, sitting and listening in, I think one thing that's lacking is that there's sort of, you know, lots of discussion about theory or whatever, but people are too nice around some things in terms of talking about what's really going on. And if we really want to try and push the social agenda, the left agenda, you know, in order for us to have that kind of survival means that our kids have to grow up in an environment that cultures that and nurtures it. And if we're attending events that aren't allowing our kids to participate in it, we're not going to have a future of adults that are going to want to participate in it.
I feel like you just read all of my notes.
I'm sorry. I did.
It's perfect.
I'm sorry. I walked out and then I walked back in. And
no, that's awesome. And that speaks also for a core value for me that is really important is teaching kids and communities to respect and acknowledge difference. And I mean, with my son, who I don't know if you caught that, is 12, or turning 12 in May, but is very, very autistic. You know, it's a huge barrier for me to find childcare that is accommodating, accessible, and even within activist communities, we've had problems, and that is kind of heartbreaking to me. And also, you know, accessibility is a huge issue. You know, I also grew up with my mother being physically disabled, so I have
kind of been sandwiched in these two different areas where, you know, I'll invite my mom to come hear me speak at something and then realize she can't because there's stairs or there's not a bathroom that's right there. You know, it's a really big issue, and I don't feel like that's addressed a lot of the time. So for a good note, though, I've seen some great community organizing work that has core values and shared values, not necessarily in New York City, but two models that I think worked very well were the Kid City, which is part of the city from below in Baltimore. I think you were there, right, with China?
Yeah, of course, I was there.
And there's this article about it in Baltimore's Independent Reader, if you Google it, and it describes, like, everything that happened that day and feedback from the organizers. But, you know, it was really involving kids in social justice work at the same time that adults were being involved. And also the 2007 U.S. Social Forum had a children's social forum. I mean, that's awesome. And it was for kids 6 to 12, and then they had child care for younger kids. So, again, they're really involving kids in social justice work, making sure that their parents have the opportunities to go do these things, and also not just babysitting, you know, but really investing. Mm-hmm. And they're planning one again for June in Detroit, right? Yeah, so they're going to do, I saw on their website that they're also doing another U.S. Social Forum Kids Track, which if anyone can out there, I can't, but...
U.S. Social Forum?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's in late June. And similarly, China Martins and Vicky Law have done this project called Don't Leave Your Friends Behind. And it's zines and tours where they talk to different groups about ways that people without kids can be allies to people with kids, which is especially important because it shouldn't always be the parent's responsibility to take care of child care because it becomes just another thing we have to do. Yeah. Right, because we're not busy enough. So. Okay. Did you want to add anything?
Well, I think my concern is, or I guess I, in my own experience as a kid growing up, I was never really exposed to any kind of social justice movement, even though I grew up in a family of the daughter of a teacher and a pastor, not kind of corporate people or anything, but still it was a very kind of sheltered suburban life, and I really wish that I had been exposed to what's going on in the world. And so that was kind of part of the impetus for Indie Kids, was that kids, even at age 9, you know, as young as 9 or younger, can be critical of the world around them and understand what's going on and can begin to start, you know, asking questions for themselves. So, and as I think about raising my kids, I want them to also be able to be part of that and to think about, I want to help them to be critical thinkers, but I'm concerned that it might, that they might have some rejection of my values.
That happens.
And so anyway, maybe some of the parents here of older kids can speak to that, and how do I involve my kids, but, you know, make sure that they're not bored, make sure that they don't say, oh, that's mom's thing, or that's, because, you know, in schools, they are exposed to Time for Kids, and if you go to the public library and go to the children's section, the publications there are Nintendo Power and Sports Illustrated for Kids, and there's really, and then of course all of being in New York, all of the ads and the you know, the materialist lifestyle, that it's just, you can't resist it. I mean, or how, you know, how do you build your resistance to this kind of thing? So I'm, maybe some of the parents can speak to that, how to build strong, independent kids.
My son's 17. And I was horrified that for a period he was going to rebel and, like, come home with an internship with Carl Rove or something. So it's hard because they really, I find kids really test you on your beliefs and your systems. It's like, okay, well, if you believe in this, Mom, why are you doing this? Why are we shopping here? So they don't have time. Conversations. But they come around because my son is here. I don't luckily he's old enough to go to the panels on his own. So having them involved, you can really build this young activist who can come into themselves before they go away to college and find all the activist things they can do or in high school. But it is horrifying to let them develop it on their own. So we find just questioning them, like, you know, all kids go through that cute anarchy phase.
Going
to find
it,
and there's some real anarchists here.
Yeah,
<it's not> right. the children anarchists are different than somebody who's actually read theory. So reading that theory and challenging them on that, it really opens up your whole world. I don't know if that helps, but it's.
I don't think there's any real. There's not going to be a program that you're going to be able to go through that's going to say that, you know, if you follow these steps, your child's going to become come out to be, you know, this social activist. I think some of it is the environment that you create as they're growing up. My kids are all now adults, but when they were younger, and I think my daughter Lindsay, who's 24, I mean, I've always said that she's been my greatest teacher in life in terms of looking, because I think society in a whole operates on such a superficial level, right? We don't consciously look at what's going around us and what's taking place. And Lindsay really helped me sort of push below that and get below the surface and really look at the things that I do that impact others. And when they were younger in elementary school, we had this issue where all kinds of money was being funded in the school. There were three kids that were fully included in the elementary side, Lindsay being one, but the other two kids had very complex disabilities, and they were in wheelchairs, but the playgrounds weren't going to be wheelchair accessible. There were no lunchrooms. The kids in the elementary wing all were sitting on the gymnasium floor to eat lunches. They were building timeout rooms, which I'm just completely opposed to. They weren't making the front of the school wheelchair accessible, but they had this nice little segregated preschool program for kids with disabilities, and they were injecting all this money there, and I spoke up at a parents' meeting. It was just, you intrinsically know that you don't believe in that, and so I spoke up. But the whole, what came out of that was a group of families that lived in the neighborhood that all spoke out against it. We fought against the school board. We ended up actually being at a point where we might have been filing lawsuits, because they just tried to block every way that the parents tried to have any voice in what was happening in this environment that affected so many kids that lived in the community. Mm-hmm. My kids are now like 19, 22, 24, and it was interesting because the other day my 19-year-old son was talking with his friends that lived in the neighborhood, and they remember the kind of craziness that was going on then, right? And so they kind of recognize the things that parents did that came together. So I think that just through your actions, your kids are going to, those, if we look at all of us, right, we hold on to memories from our childhood and different things that really meant, that helped shape us in who we were growing up. And I think, you know, if that's the kind of environment you're creating for your children, that they're going to absorb that. And they'll move into those directions. And for me, the biggest goal is I want my kids to feel confident enough in who they are to actually give themselves their own voice, that they can speak against something when they may be the only person in the room that will actually say it. Because quite often, there's more than one thing to say.
Yeah, I think that.
Go on.
Okay.
I just want to support what you said, Anna. Indie Kids, my church gave space to Indie Kids. Wow. I signed the paper. But anyhow, I think it's modeling, being ourselves, doing our work and modeling that kind of good work for our children.
Make that circle bigger. Excuse that circle bigger.
And like, for example, when my daughter was really young, she's 21 now, and she became aware of people being homeless in New York City, and we would, you know, talk about homelessness. We have one day she said, well, why don't you volunteer at the homeless shelter, Mom? And it was for me to listen to her and say, my first response was, I don't have time. That's why I give money. Well, Mom, wouldn't it be much better for you to volunteer? Let's volunteer. And I followed her. You know, when she just entered sixth grade, she came home one day. Mom, they want me. Who wants you for what, Lena? They wanted her to be a peer mediator. And I said, you just started sixth grade. You're taking a week out of your first semester of sixth grade to study to be a peer mediator? I don't think so. And then I thought again. And I said, this program looks great, Educators for Social Responsibility. I said, take the week. And I liked the program so much, I went up there and said, I want to learn more about it. I want to be here. And I want to learn to be a trainer for you. And I do that, too. So it's, in a sense, I think I'm talking about modeling our best values, but also creating the space to learn from our children. Because they nail us on stuff. They see it, and it's clear. Simple questions. Why don't you?
I think I just want to echo what both of you are saying, because I think it just really resonates with how we think about childcare as movement-building work, and that raising children is part of like creating sustainable movements, but not because we're trying to create these like little soldiers of that are going to grow up to be like these cadre of activists, but rather that we're going to do precisely that, like engage kids in questions and encourage them in their self-determination and like fighting all the different forms of various social oppressions that they're facing as young kids. And so I think that's one of the things that we, when we talk about like why it's important to build relationships beyond just providing childcare and meeting, or kind of what you were saying about really incorporating children, that, you know, I think many of us have developed relationships with kids where we see them outside, we go to their birthday parties, we're part of their lives, and we're just another adult that's also like helping them kind of be who they are and be the person they are. And I think that kind of going back to the conversation about nannies, that a lot of our work is with Domestic Workers United, and I think that some of the things that we really see eye to eye with them on is really valuing the work that nannies do and really talking about how important it is and how essential it is. And they are doing a lot of work in terms of getting dignity and respect for nannies, but also kind of trying to change labor laws to get that work recognized. And I think that also has a lot of overlap with what we're trying to do here and how we think of childcare.
If you don't mind just introducing yourselves.
I'm Ricky. I'm a teacher.
I'm Farhan Badani, a student at UCLA, actually.
Wow, that's far.
Okay. At Canada and California.
Oh, and you know, I completely agree with you about learning from the young. I have a 25-year-old daughter. But one thing I want to say is, you know, as parents, we tend to think we have more control than we do and to blame ourselves when we don't. And one of the sayings that I've always hated and now believe is Khalil Gibran saying, your children are not your children, you know, it's a Sweet Honey in the Rock song. So much as we try to instill certain kinds of values in our children, they grow up in this society, and we have so little control over what they believe. And I want to say that because it's so easy to feel guilty about what you're not able to accomplish. Now, I also have to say that my daughter, who has a leftist mother, a leftist father and a leftist stepmother, is not a leftist. And and was dragged to, you know, like the gay pride march and didn't like the drumming. But she also challenged me recently on why I have multiple sclerosis, why I don't go to the MS march, and she has pushed me to go. And although I have some criticisms of the MS Society, I'm not telling them to her. I'm going to go. This is the first collective action that she has proposed. So
I'm going to be there.
So what I'm trying to say is that we're in a contradiction because we want to teach kids to question authority, but not ours. And we want to instill our values, but they are going to be their own people.
I don't think you introduced yourself yet.
My name is Sherry Brown.
So another
question. Are you Jay French?
No. We're with Rahan Racy on Child Care Club. Should we reintroduce ourselves because we've had a lot of people kind of walk in? So I'm Jennifer Silverman, and I'm here talking about my experience with MAMA, a collective of radical mothers in New York City, and other community organizing work that I've done. And I have a 12-year-old and a 4-year-old.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. We're Henry Sion with Child Care Collective in New York. A couple of us are here, but Illy and I were...
I can't hear whatever you're saying.
I didn't say my name. I'm Lauren. Sorry. She was telling me her name. I'm Lauren.
And I'm Ian. I'm in the band. Yeah.
And I'm Amanda Bender. I work with Indie Kids. And Jen invited me to be part of the panel, which is a group discussion. And I'm a full-time parent of a 2.5-year-old.
And we've gone to some, at least one march together with our kids who may or may not remember or have enjoyed it. So another question that we had were, what are creative ways that our organization or groups have made their work family inclusive within the organization and at possible actions? Sorry, I have handwriting all over my carefully typed notes. So, the focus was on creative ways.
And when I was working at Teachers College as a supervisor, there was quite a few of us who had new babies and small children, and we were supervisors, but we formerly were full-time teachers, and then we were working just part-time for the college. And they brought in a graduate student who was watching some of the kids. So we kind of did an hour-and-a-half collective. And some of us who just had nursing babies kept our babies with us. So it worked out nice because we were working at a predominantly woman, historically woman profession, a teacher's college, which is, very female supportive. And then he's been home this year going to meetings, not working for Teachers College, but from After America. And he's like, oh, no, you can't bring your kids. Because it's like historically a male-dominated profession. So I kind of noticed that. But wow, good for Teachers College. It was kind of seemed so obvious to me to do that, and then I think it's pretty much because we were a group of women that we thought of it. It's not something that Columbia necessarily would come up with.
I don't know if anyone remembers the Easter Bunny Liberation Organization. No? Okay. So this is going back to the beginning of the now 7-year war in Iraq, and when I was working with MAMA, we did a lot of organizing before and during the start of the war. And my friend Amy, who was one of the core group members of MAMA, saw that there were toys in Easter baskets. And she got very outraged and decided to dress up in a bunny suit and stand in Kmart and had a sign that said something like, "There's G.I. Joe is in my Easter basket." And she was arrested and then was interviewed on Democracy Now! And it made news like Japanese television. It was crazy. It got picked up and all over. And so from that one event that she did by herself, we kind of expanded it and started, sending out press releases as the Friends of Chocolate Bunnies and the Easter Bunny Liberation Organization, and involved our kids in a way that was fun for them. They got to wear bunny masks and have, Easter egg baskets and hang outside in the beautiful spring weather and dance. And we had leaflets to hand out, and we made sure that the kids were always safe and away from the street. But so we were outside of the Kmart at Astor Place, for several weekends in a row. And
I mean, that was one of the most fun experiences I've ever had as an activist, was seeing these kids with these signs, you know, make chocolate, not war. And I think it was a way to kind of teach our values with something that, you know, they would have ordinarily seen an Easter basket right at that time of the year, but to be able to say, like, make that connection at their developmental level to why it's inappropriate to have a war toy in an Easter basket, you know, and not necessarily from a religious perspective, but just from more of a humanist perspective, was really great. Throw it to you guys.
Well, this A... forgot your name. What's your name again?
My name?
Yes.
Janice.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about how you did some children's programming that was alongside adults programming. We did a similar thing at the Critical Resistance 10 conference last summer, two summers ago. Which the Critical Resistance is an organization that is... I like blanked on every word. They're
prison
basically,
abolition.
Yeah, prison abolition stuff. So, yeah, breaking down the prison industrial complex and had a whole conference on that. And we ran a parallel conference for kids,
wow.
Which was great and really stretched us, I think. And we learned a lot in that process about kids programming and about like what. How to teach about the prison industrial complex to 4-year-olds. So you said, like, what does that mean exactly? And like, if, you know, and knowing that there's kids there who have been affected by that system very intimately and kids that have not been affected by that system, but whose parents are involved in the work. And yeah, so that was something. It was a very creative process. It was really, It was fun, and I think it helped us even to learn a little, or at least it helped me like learn about distilling the politics down to something more like values.
I've just been thinking as I hear everyone speak about how and Jen's idea about. You're sharing about the bunny, the Easter thing, and how I think really organizing or involving kids in our work is really about good organizing, it seems like, even for adults, because one, it's like through Indie Kids, a lot of adults say, you know, I'm so glad I read Indie Kids because it helps us to understand what's going on, because it's everything's kind of boiled down into a couple paragraphs. In a way, that's, you know, in some ways what we need to do in our flyers and, you know, we're making our political aims accessible to people and then also make it fun and catchy, like this Easter Bunny thing and something, and that's also very useful. And then also building a community where all people feel included. And I was an activist in the Philippines for a few years, and I always... admired how, well, the activist movement in the Philippines is much, well, it's bigger than it is here. So people have very differentiated tasks. And I remember in the labor organization where I volunteered, there was this guy who was coming around the office and he painted banners, and that's all he did. He just painted the banners, and, you know, he didn't know how to use the computer, whereas here, I feel like I have to do everything. I have to know the website. I have to be able to, you know, answer the phones. Anyway, it's, you know, answer the voicemail. And I think there has to be some kind of what we call in education differentiated instruction and differentiated acceptance of what people want to contribute and accept that kids can contribute in different ways as adults can, and maybe you've got someone who just colors or paints banners, that's good, and that's how they can contribute. And so anyway, I'm just kind of getting a sense that it's that community that we need to create that will help our kids feel welcome and adults too.
I had one other thought. When I used to plan, I still do, retreats, I would make sure that some of our retreats for adults and children were held in unconventional places, like why not go to Gallaudet for a retreat, or University for the Hearing Impaired or Deaf, or the, years ago I remember taking a group to vacation camp for the blind. And, you know, if you do it right and you prepare everyone to come in respectfully, this is not a field trip to see how blind folks live. But do it respectfully and have some interaction, at least have a sense of another world. Sometimes when I have retreats, I try to set them up in a place that might have a group of, say, sunshine kids with very different from our children. How do we create an opportunity for the norm to come in right and respectfully and make friends and learn from others? I think that can be a missed opportunity when you think of where to hold an event and what programming you might want from within the what's available from the site that you choose, and who's going to be there August 15th when I bring my group. Or maybe I want to come a week earlier when you have a very different group that I want to get in some kind of a relationship with. And with the Sunshine Kids, we now have joint events every other year, so that's kind of a cool outcome.
Actually, that's a perfect segue into our next question, which was, how do we foster inclusion of families with varying needs, including parents or kids with disabilities, in our work? Okay, I can run with that. So I mentioned at the start of the session that I had co-edited an anthology called My Baby Rides the Short Bus, The Unabashedly Human Experience of Raising Kids with Special Needs, and that's a long title, subtitle. And part of the reason that I did that project, which was about 3 years of my life with my co-editors, was because not only did we want a touchstone for other parents who identified, you know, outside of the mainstream, but were parenting kids with special needs to be able to relate to, but we really wanted to bring other people in from the outside who weren't parenting kids with special needs and share our experiences and how they could be allies. So there's a lot about different experiences we've had, but also situations where we've had to be activists and advocates and how that's worked. So specifically, you know, through MAMA, I've done skill shares with other organizations and talked about how they could be accommodating to kids with special needs when they were doing collective child care at events or otherwise. And I think it kind of scares people to think, you know, first of all, that they're setting up this child care, but then there are these other issues that they have to bring in. And I really encourage people to ask questions before they say, no, we can't do it, because you don't know if you can do it, especially at a conference that's at a university that might have an education, a special education department. You might be able to call on teachers in training to come help out and do that for the day. Or, you know, this isn't the best example because it kind of could have ended disastrously, but I spoke at a conference, NCORE, a few years ago in D.C., and I was presenting, strangely enough, on raising kids with special needs in activist communities. And I called before and made sure that they had a one-on-one for my son, who was, I think, five or six at the time. And, you know, they had everything under control, made all these arrangements, and then a few hours later found him wandering alone in the hallway. Yeah. It's really good timing that I happened to be out in the hallway at that time, because he's completely nonverbal. And he had, you know, a tag on his shoe with his phone number and his name and everything else. But that skill, like, to this day, that scares me. And almost, I tear up, like, practically every time I talk about it. So also, you need to be realistic in what you can do. If you really can't do it, if you can't accommodate me or my friends, then don't do it. Mm-hmm. But think about it first. And one thing what I mentioned before, what Vicky and China were doing with their Don't Leave Your Friends Behind zine and project, is that I've worked with them and came up with a list of suggestions for people trying to set that up. So that's available also somewhere on the interwebs. But
what's it called?
Don't Leave Your Friends Behind, and there's a Blogspot page about it. And, you know, I have a zine presentation from what we did once at a workshop. If anyone wants to email me for that, so I'll leave my email before I leave. But, you know, I don't think a movement can be sustainable without everybody involved. And I mean everybody. So, and also, I've been really lucky that my older son, he really craves a lot of sensory input. So he loves going to marches. He thinks they're like the funnest thing ever, especially with the percussion. So, like, the drumming experience you had. So, you know, it's been more challenging as he's gotten older because now he doesn't really want to always come along with me, and he's my height, and he can just kind of lead me away. But, yeah, I think one of the most fantastic experiences I had was bringing him to a march where someone actually came up and thanked me for bringing him there. And I want more of that. But I don't want it to be, I want it to be the norm. I don't want to be the exception.
Yeah, like the last thing you said made me think of something in Manuacion that I think we thought about, which is that has really come up for us over the years, which is kind of being a collective of people that are committing to doing work with children. Can oftentimes people say, okay, you're the people that take care of the kids. And instead of, and what we've sort of come back and said is, no, actually, part of what we want to do is be a catalyst for everyone committing to caretaking. And I think it's, and then that moves outside of just caretaking for children without disabilities, but it's like anybody that has any need, right? Whether it's a child, somebody that has difficulties because they're very old, you know, any of us that have any sort of need to be cared for, it's like, I think it sort of, the greater push is just around a culture of caretaking. And I think that we've found this to be a necessary push to make, also within left political culture. You know, we kind of talked about the left one here in terms of the childcare, but also just in terms of like refreshments and some water. You know, like there's nothing really that cozy about just, you know. And maybe it's particularly acute in the U.S. because I think also in the U.S. we do kind of have these notions though of activist cultures. I think in a lot of other places I've been, you don't have to identify as an activist to be somebody that is going to go out in the streets to protest against something having to do with an attack on labor or with war. But I feel like much more here, it's kind of like very much tied into an activist identity. And I think it's precisely that same activist identity, that's the identity that is kind of a superhero, doesn't like have to take care of kids, doesn't have to be taken care of in any way. So I think the kind of the two pieces are kind of interconnected. Like things that are weak about the left, like are like kind of a little deeper than you know, than just like how are we going to get childcare done? But kind of like
how are we going to value caregiving?
Yeah, how are we going to value caregiving?
Well, the right certainly doesn't do it at all.
But the right is a clear division of labor.
But even in terms of including like even in terms of that, it also, the right also isolates a lot of other people, right? Anybody that's marginalized and indifferent, you know, or sort of separated out and put in a different box. And, and you know, you had mentioned, and it's true, one of my friends was actually going to one of the sessions earlier, one of the panelists couldn't get into the Shimola Auditorium because it wasn't accessible. So,
you have a panelist that you're inviting to speak at an event, and then you don't even think how they're going to get there. So it goes back to that whole issue, I think, of the fact that, you know, in society, I think we operate pretty unconsciously in terms of what looking at environment and how it's going to impact an individual. As long as we take care of ourselves, we don't really worry about anybody else. And it's the same thing even in terms of any social justice groups, right? If I look at the union that I'm involved with, you know, I mean, there's many members that, there's a number of them that have kids with disabilities. I think there's people that I don't even know, that co-workers don't even know that they have sons and daughters with developmental disabilities or physical disabilities, or a partner that has a disability, or people that have mental health issues, or like, are they, you know, living with violence. And so we don't even create a space within the union to invite people to be there and be supported and nurtured, which also contributes to them wanting to be more active, right? So I see that as one of the biggest fundamental challenges, I think, with respect to the left movement.
Well, I want to pick up on that as a disabled person. I can walk a bit. Every time there's an event, and I have 3,000 emails on my thing. Every time there's an event, I have to find out as an individual whether it's accessible or whether I need to make different kinds of arrangements, which means everybody like me has to individually find out. So I've been on a campaign to try to get all of our organizations, when we advertise events, to say whether it's accessible and in what way. Now, I know that given that space is at a premium and that we don't have money, a lot of the things are done in churches, which have beautiful stairs. So in a lot of the cases, we are not going to be able to have events at accessible spaces. But at least we need to know what the problems are. Because, for instance, if I know that there are stairs, I know I can't take my scooter, so then I have to try to take a cab or access a ride. May it rest in peace. You know I have to make strategies. But before I make strategies, I have to find out, and it shouldn't be necessary for every individual to find out about every event. It should be part of making an announcement of an event.
It does get exhausting to have to ask.
Well, it's like using a lens in anything, right? People talk about looking at something and applying the feminist lens, and it's no different than when you're talking about applying a lens in terms of looking at issues about accessibility and accommodating for people's differences. I have to say that I was quite pleased coming in this room and seeing people sitting in a circle, which I think is more inviting for dialogue than what I've experienced the rest of the weekend. So, here's a great job.
I'm timekeeping also, so we have about a half an hour until 5 o'clock. And we kind of already answered the next two questions, so I'm going to skip ahead to this last question. And then what we originally planned was to do a Q&A for a few minutes, if anyone has any lingering questions from what we were just talking about, but then also break out into a couple of groups and strategize and try to make some positive action steps for things that can happen, which I'm told is not another thing that the Left Forum doesn't usually do, but...
Yeah, I think it's more panel as opposed to workshop.
Yeah, let's shake it up a little bit. Yeah. So we've got some big paper and some markers. So the last question, and it's related to parenting and what Amanda was talking about, is how can we support kids who are socially conscious and face problems at school or in the community as a result?
Mm-hmm. Say it one more time.
How can we support kids who are socially conscious and face problems at school or in the community as a result?
I think parents being involved is key. I teach at the same school my child goes to, and I've been really impressed with, like, we just finished a unit on persuasive writing, and because they've been in the school for so long, like, there were some really good arguments, like, why gay marriage is a civil rights issue, saying no to hamburger, and why, like, a lot of them are all reading the Eric Schlossinger book for kids about why, like, fast food is bad. And I think a lot of it stems from that the parents came in years and years ago before we even had kids and started, like, Green and Healthy Month And we have a school-wide book campaign where once a month we all read the same book and discuss these issues in the book, the social issues in it. And I think that that's raised these kids that are now in fifth grade and even generations before them that have come through that have a sense of community and have an idea that, like, there's these corporations that are influencing me and there's, you know, I can make healthy choices. And so I think that getting involved in your PTA is important. And that schools can make a difference if parents have to be the impetus for that change.
Yeah, my son goes to Urban Academy High School in New York City, and when he first started going there, I started looking at it, and I still wish I could still go to that school. Because they do have, just to show what a public school can do, they do have child care for the teachers in the school and also for the children, because it's a high school. It's a small school in the Julia Richmond Educational Complex. They have about six other schools there, and one is an autistic school. And they bring the kids, a lot of those kids.
Is the school in Chelsea?
No. It's in up on 67th on the east side.
Okay.
And so a lot of those kids come up and take classes with the kids in Urban Academy, because it's also the classes aren't based by what grade you're in. It's all the new kids and the graduating seniors all are taking classes together and having open discussions. Mm-hmm. And they kind of have an activist history. They encourage the kids to find something they're passionate about and organize around them and try to change as they're also organizing and trying to save their own school at times. So I think we can push public schools to do more in that fashion as we push our own groups.
I think that, it's a challenge, right? Because, you know, of course, within schools, it's dependent sometimes on the administrator that's in the school system. They sort of set the tone in terms of the way things happen. Because my kids have been in schools where they've had very supportive relationships with educators. That's been wonderful. And when my daughter Lindsay was going on to junior high school, she's 24. She's never been in any kind of special program her entire life. She's always been, and when I say fully included, I mean going to our neighborhood school, being in a grade one class, not being in a special ed program at a school, and then you get to go visit for art class or music
grade. Right.
And even at high school level, it was like telling them, what do you have? They've got their very advanced academic classes. Well, that's where I want Lindsay. You know, and she attended post-secondary education. We've got fully inclusive supports for people to attend post-secondary university in Alberta, in Canada, where I live. There's, in Edmonton, I think we've got 5 different post-secondary institutions where they're supporting adults with developmental disabilities and some with very complex needs to be very, like, completely included and fully participatory in post-secondary educational learning. And I think in terms of helping kids feel that they can create a voice, you have to create that inclusive environment at a very early age. And, you know, so the way to do that and for them to speak out is to show that there's that ability for anybody and that you learn off of one another. You know, so there are a lot of kids that their life is very different growing up in a school where it embraces diversity, right? Not just based on disability, but based on, you know, cultural backgrounds and based on, you know, different family dynamics, you know, single parent homes, same sex marriage, you know, everything. And so it sort of gives you exactly what the real world is like. And I think the more sanitized an educational system is, I think the harder it is for there to be a place for kids to really be able to speak out.
Yeah, I think it's important to, like what you were saying earlier, Jen, about, like, valuing difference, like, knowing that that there are different people. And that's okay, and that not everyone's going to agree with you, and you're not going to agree with everyone else, and that's totally fine, because you can't kill them, really. We just have to accept that we're all in this world together, and get through it. And I also think that, as far as, support for kids who may be feeling ostracized, I think that, I think this is hard work, and it's hard for all of us. It's hard for adults. It's hard for kids, everyone. And that what feels good is to have, just to have a community that, supports you and a place to go that feels safe. And that's, our families and our chosen families and, the communities that we're a part of. But I think that, I think it is, I think it isn't, I don't know, I'm trying to say it in a different way, what I was saying about, it being important that kids interact with people that are different than them. But I think that,
But the education system, and just in terms of the curriculum, doesn't have that kind of stuff even in there. In the educational, they don't teach that, right? If you look at curriculum-based learning, they don't have a lot in there that really encourages kids to think about stuff like that.
I would argue
at politics and everything else. I don't know, maybe in Canada it's a bit different, but it's very much, I think it's a watered-down, very conservative approach to look at what the way society is. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's gives people a real clear picture, but I think it's sanitized.
So, wait, I'm a little bit confused. So are you saying that that's where our energy should be going, is getting the curriculum in a better condition?
I think we need to look at influencing what's in curriculum, because I think government has too much control over that.
Okay. I guess I would say it just as, I know you're...
And I'm speaking from a Canadian perspective, so mm-hmm. I'm not sure, but I certainly know that in Canada... The influences around developing curriculum is primarily from the government, and depending on province to province. And unfortunately, I live in a very conservative, right-wing, Christian, reform, very, very right approach to things. And so, the curriculum there is very right in terms of the way it looks at things.
Sure. I think, though, that, I think it's a part of it,
yep.
And I think that there's a lot of parts that look really similar in our world and our structure, and I think there's a lot of institutions that are insane, and I guess I'm interested in, or I was talking from a place of in general, our kids are we all do, we just run into all of these things, and yeah, some people choose to put a lot of their energy towards different kinds of reforming kind of work, but I think it's also important to in the movement building world and the left world that it's important to be able to even think about within that, okay, even if we don't, even though we're not totally putting our energy into this, having kids be able to talk about things and having the kids be able to tell the teachers that they want them, whatever, go on and on.
I can't believe I'm about to say kids today, but I think that something that kids today have that we didn't have growing up is that there's all the social networking, there's blogging, there are communities outside of our walls that kids can go to and find support in. I was that kid when I was 14 and socially conscious and activist, and I can't say that I ever had a problem because of it, but there weren't that many people I could talk to about it. So I think, kids have a larger advantage in that way than we ever had growing up. So I'm just going to, so we have 21 minutes. Do you want to go break out and do this activity or continue with question and answer and dialogue? Because I'm up for whatever.
What would the activity entail?
Okay, so we just came up with some guiding questions and an activity. It sounds more organized than it actually is, but the activity is develop a plan to make your organization, group, collective, activist community more family-friendly and come up with some concrete steps that people can take, whether it's within your group or a larger community idea.
We could do that. Could I just say, because the left form not being child-friendly is a problem.
here, is there a way that we can just kind of come together with stuff that we might want to approach or...
And give them ideas for next year?
And give them ideas for next year.
I think that's awesome.
A good idea. I like that.
Okay, do you want to do it as one group or two groups?
I think one group.
One, we're small enough.
Okay, so we'll just, if someone wants to, if someone wants to volunteer, I'm going to... If someone wants to volunteer, to present it also. Why not? You know, I mean, I don't think they hate children or anything. I think it just wasn't...
I think, like, every group, and we do the same thing. You have a goal that you want to do, you have limited time, and you chop it down to the problems that you know and things that you need to do.
Sure, and it just wasn't one of the core issues that they were working on. I mean, I've been told it was an insurance issue in the past. I don't know what that means. So
I think that's,
I think there's a university with a huge amount of...
Maybe the insurance issue is child care versus what we might be able to propose, which is family events. Because no one would be legally liable for my child if I'm there.
But then you don't get to go...
But then we could plan a day of family events, which to me would be...
Or at least have a family.
Okay. Well, no, I'm saying there is child care. Like I said, it's two different issues, like child care. But then also, like next year when I have an almost 7-year-old, could we do something that involves her? And to me, that would be more exciting than child care.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think that would be...
I don't think they're mutually exclusive, I think. Right. Right. Like, there's a way to do both.
But I'm saying if they're talking about the liability issue, having family-friendly events wouldn't be the liability issue. I think the child care is the liability issue. The fact that I would leave my child with somebody is the issue.
Yeah, and, you know, it's been held at CUNY before. I don't know how many years it's been at Pace, but it's just interesting to me because, you know, I've been to other events at other universities where it just hasn't been an issue. They're like, okay, here's your room. You know, here are a couple of volunteers. It's been a lot easier.
Some people hear keywords and they just say, oh, well, we can't do that. So they hear insurance.
So we need a groundswell. Okay, so...
So is there an issue, like, if you leave, you know, you're on the floor below, there's activities, not, like Linda was suggesting, not just someone to watch the kitten, but there's actually something like Raymond or Asion does, where there's some kind of
Well, complete what their plan was.
I was going to say you can approach it two different ways. Mm-hmm. You can do two things. Mm-hmm. You can have the child care, and then they have, 13 panels? I mean, 13 sessions, or maybe it's
time
slots? Yeah, time slots. And challenging other activist groups to come up with a child-friendly panel, like each... thing. Like, so
like a kid's track.
One children option each session. I don't think that would be too much to ask from anybody, and it would be a chance to network with these groups to challenge them to be more family.
If they can do it on a social forum level, then how can they not do it on a 2-day conference in New York?
Yeah.
It's just interesting. That was part of our participation in the Allied Media Conference in Detroit, was about in what way can you sort of create a track of intergenerational things. Not necessarily like kids' track, like this is the place where kids go to do their thing, because you can kind of do that with like a child care space that is a little more than warehousing, that's like activities that engage with the themes or whatever. But like a space where adults and kids can go do things, and the people that are presenting those things have activities that are relevant for multiple ages. That's like an interesting thing to push, because then you make the person be like, well, so I have what I'm going to say when I sit down in front of people in the panel, but then what am I going to do for like the 5-year-olds in the room who don't want to sit around and be quiet while adults talk about capitalism? So like,
I don't see it's that big of a challenge, considering I think there's a lot of educators that come to this, like a lot of educators on panels. So how big of a challenge can it be? Like, I mean, I could things that we could do. Like, are we brainstorming actual activities or just...
I think more like structures.
Right, structures. Okay, so it's different. But, like, I don't think it would be that challenging for a lot of people who come.
I think, like, what I always find is that, say they make a working group about this at Left Forum, like, I don't want to be part of the working group. You know, I just want to come participate.
Right.
Yeah. And that's kind of a problem. Like, who starts it if it's not the parents?
I mean, who initiates getting child care, getting them to get child care, or?
Well, yeah, like.
Who's part of the working group?
Who takes the actual responsibility for making sure it happens, as opposed to, like, who suggests it, and then, you know, I don't want to go up with this great idea and walk away, but at the same time, like, I have, you know.
No, which is, I think we can just go ahead and bring this to a form and check.
Oh, yeah, I don't mean literally. I just want to make sure that, like, that it's not the parents who wind up doing the organizing for the parent activities.
I think, for example, educators who are committed to socio-emotional learning would be great people to involve, whether they're parents or not.
Right, well, there's people here already presenting about, like, school reform ideas and talking about, what was it, more democratic education, or, like people are already having those conversations, so I can't imagine that you couldn't find people among those groups, whether they have kids or not, that wouldn't be willing to do an hour and a half of an activity that would involve doing that.
So what are some basic needs that Left Forum would have to provide in order to have these kind of things?
Well, number one, is space.
And I think more of an actual sliding scale.
Do you mean in terms of just getting in?
Yeah.
Oh, getting in.
Then there should be like a family ticket.
The Left Forum, I just don't think they publicize it, but they have a policy that anybody who wants to come to Left Forum, they will get to the Left Forum. So if you can't pay the thing, if you can't pay the low income, if you can't pay the group rate, if you can't pay, they'll accommodate you.
Normally when I can't pay, I just don't go, though.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They need to be more upfront about it.
Something, right?
Or something.
They didn't tell volunteers that either. Because I volunteered yesterday at an info table, and I was like, I don't know if you can get in, but you can just try.
Yeah.
Go to the workshop.
I volunteered them doing outreach.
Right.
And we were going to make the road, or we were going to all these different groups. And they're like, well, you know, I don't think we can get people to pay that much. I was like, well, I think they'll work with you if we can get a group together.
So the model they had this year that fell apart was that they were contracting with an outside daycare. I'm going to pay them to provide this childcare space, which first, like, wasn't ideal because it's not in the same building. Mm-hmm. But it was a licensed daycare that's what they did for a living, mm-hmm. so you knew it was going to be, you know, sanitary and well-staffed and et cetera, et cetera. And then I think the way it was explained to me was that they were going to charge a flat fee regardless of how many children came, whether if it was 2 or 200. And Left Forum couldn't economically subsidize that, and they didn't know that until they were in the contracting phase, and then they didn't have a backup plan. So, you know, that's one way to not go for next year, is to go outside. I think, you know, why not rely on volunteers instead of paying $15,000 to a daycare center?
In that respect, it seems like a recommendation related to some of the stuff you said earlier as well would be something about, like, an organizing, as much as a conference is an organizing process, there's an organizing process that goes to creating intergenerational aspects of. So, like, that's a focus of organizing work, not necessarily. So, like, it can be looked at in that way. It can be looked at as the thing that we raise money so we can contract out and get it out of the way so the organizing work can take place. But it can also be a thing that you draw on organizers for whom that's, you know, something that they put their energies into. And that's part of their political practice. And that is something that, like, needs to be initiated early, like, have the input of parents and families, but not rely exclusively on their energies to be organized. But that's a process that has its own.
So just right now, ask parents what they need or expect of child care.
And I'd say commit organizing energy to it early.
And I think in terms of resources, you're going to need enough people to manage the space and all of the children and families who show up. I think that that's important because so often not enough thought is given to that part of it. And also to have the right volunteers, not just any volunteer. And that's hard, you know. We're all well-intended, but there's got to be a vetting process to know who are these volunteers, what's the background.
Right,
and
like, I was going to jump on that. Like, if it's just volunteers, I would think
See, we had set up with Mama when we were doing this a way to kind of have checks and balances if it was people we didn't know. Like,
so you're a much smaller organization than this.
Right, but
you know, there would never be less than two people in a room who could watch with the other two adults in a room. So there'd never be a one adult alone with a child.
Right.
Even, you know, bathroom trips, anything like that. There would never just be one adult because you don't know what's going to happen. And for me, with a nonverbal child, like,
right,
I can't
right.
rely on him telling me. So, you know, the best child care I ever had in an event was by accident. A woman who is a professor at Columbia happened to be somewhere and took care of him. And she knew people I knew. So,
right.
you know, but that is an issue. Like, they're not going to fingerprint people to come do child care at Left Forum. So how do you...
But you could get people, you could get child care givers who have been fingerprinted. I mean, you could build. I mean, if or whatever, but that could be built into the system too.
You could even start small, just like Saturday will be family day, and on Saturday we'll have family-friendly activities, and not go the child care route because I really do think you're getting into more liabilities that way, and not that I don't think that that's any. I guess I see it more as like I would want something that included my family. I probably wouldn't bring my kids to a daycare here. I would probably just leave them in Brooklyn in daycare. For me. Mm-hmm. Because if they're just going to be at daycare while I'm doing something else anyway, I would leave them with someone I know.
Yeah.
So what I would envision as being more meaningful would be like family day where like there's activities that we're all doing together. And they're part of it. And I'm not saying other people wouldn't want child care and that it wouldn't be better for other people that way. I'm just voicing that that isn't what I was envisioning.
Although it might be 3 years as opposed to paying for it.
Exactly, right. And 3 is good, but not, I mean, well, it's a year old.
Dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of parents are going to be crazy about the idea of an event this large, having their kid in a room with people that they don't know where home to.
Yeah.
I think, sorry, I have to apologize, I'm not feeling well, so I sort of haven't said anything and also have been in another room. But I do want to say that, like, I feel like what we're talking about, like, totally, I mean, it directly relates to the idea or the, like, the values behind creating buildings, spaces that are, like, spaces of caretaking in which people, like, and in which, like, all different kinds of adults and older kids and whatever, like, come to expect to take some sort of responsibility so that it's, like, more of a communal sharing of caretaking, and that the more we build those kinds of spaces, the more parents are able to trust that, like, if they, you know, aren't watching their kid, like, for every second, that, like, someone else is going to be there who is going to be like, oh, you know, like, take responsibility too. And I think that that's kind of a lot of what we try to do with Rehabilitación is, like, because we're trying to get away from this idea that we are just these, like, people to come do child care in this separate space, and, like, you know, parents, of course, have differing feelings about whether or not they know us or trust us or want to leave their kids in, you know, or have certain ideas about what kind of space they want to leave their kids in. And so I just think that, like, I like the idea of having events or activities or certain panels or whatever that are, like, focused on, like, being intergenerational or family-friendly, but then, you know, obviously it's a longer-term thing to think about how to build bigger spaces where you can come with your kids and know that they're not just going to be in a room with people you don't know, and then getting into all of this, you know, sort of bureaucratic, like, oh, well, have they been fingerprinted or not? You know, like, I don't know, I guess building our own ways of building our own kinds of trust and our own ways of knowing without going through, like, the state to be defining, like, who is a good caretaker or not.
Right. Yeah.
Some of the concerns that you raised, I think, are exactly what sets the bar higher for maybe why you're saying it seems like an easier initial step to encourage intergenerational tracks and panels and stuff than to do a separate child care space that has its own locality or whatever, because the bar for that seems to be higher. Because if concerns are you don't know who's taking care of the kids and you don't know what they're doing, then that means that the space needs to be organized in such a way that you have some idea of who's taking care of the kids, and you know that they're going to be doing something that's cool and enriching, you know. So, which seems to say that then you want, you don't want to have to make this choice of, like, are they going to sit in a room with people they know here or sit in a room with people they don't know at this conference that I'm going to? It would be much cooler if it was a choice of, should I send them for the day with people that I know? Or should I send them to this cool kids program that they're running with this kind of, you know, collective that I kind of know about that's been organizing this stuff? That sounds interesting, and that's a choice I can actually make, you know.
And just also what Al's saying, like, you know, I don't really need the state to tell me who's a qualified caregiver. It's just, you know, that's one way of knowing that they're not a convicted child molester, for example. But, you know, my son was in a program that was run by the agency that runs his school, where somebody who was fingerprinted and vetted did physically hurt him. So, you know, even in that, there's no guarantee.
Yep. That's true.
Unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to think of, like, you know, looking through the panels, I find it hard. It seems to me like kind of a big jump to make some of these family friendly. So anyway, I'm curious if you all have ideas. I mean, maybe you have this Indie Kids coloring book, which I don't know. Maybe at a panel you could have crayons and some coloring books for some kids to work on while you have the panel up there speaking. But you know, that seems, it's a very small step, but I'm not really quite sure how to make a lot of these panels that are so, you know, so stodgy.
I don't know how we can solve that in 4 minutes.
I mean, I think one of the reasons that Regeneración, like, as a group, has not really partnered with the Left Forum, but we have partnered with the Allied Media Conference in Detroit or the Critical Resistance Conference, or had done work in conjunction with other people, the social forums, that there's kind of a particularly, there's a particular stodginess to this. I mean, like, I think you kind of get in where you fit in, and I think there's been spaces and places where we've been able to make interventions where, like, people are like, yes, we really want this, and it's great that you're going to, like, kind of support us in making this change that we want to make, you know, which I think is really different than our experience has been here, which is more just about kind of, we want to take care of this problem, you know, because I think even, like, definitely here we would love to have coloring books and kids, but you know what I mean, like, I think we've been in a lot of different workshops over the past, you know, 2 days or whatever, we're like, just, you know, you would get that look. You would be the group of people that would get that look in the room. So I think for whatever reason, this particular forum has been one that's hard to make that kind of intervention in. You know, and I don't know if it's a particular left culture, you know, or if it's just like whatever. Maybe it's more more rooted in the academy, maybe, which, you know, I mean, I'm not quite clear on that, but...
Well, it was the Socialist Scholars Conference. I mean, it's
just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, but just to say this, I think there's a particular reason why we haven't, like, you know, like, made sort of deeper interventions around this particular.
I think there are more groups that aren't scholarly that are involved in that form now, that we should be able to do it.
I'm going to suggest, just because of the lack of time, that if people want to take this discussion over email, if you want to leave your email addresses on my enormous pad of paper, that you know, I can create some sort of list that, if you know, we're serious about bringing this by email. You don't have to.
Well, I just want to thank you, Jen, for putting together this panel and for, like, doing all the work, your kind of work of getting us into this. So thank you so much for that.
Yeah. Sure. I'll sponsor this panel.